the ballot for one party or another. That makes a lot of sense.
Ari Berman, I want to thank you for being with us, covering voting rights for the nation. His book is titled Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He's in Chicago today, headed to Wisconsin tomorrow for the Wisconsin primary. And that does it for our show. We're on our 100-city tour starting this week on April 6th. That's Wednesday. I'll be in Ithaca on Friday, Columbus, Ohio, April 8th. Then St. Louis, Columbia, Missouri, and Kansas City on the 9th. At the Los Angeles Times Book Festival on the 10th, and Santa Barbara in the evening of that day. On Monday, the 11th, we'll be in San Francisco. On the 12th, at Stanford University and in Santa Clara. Go to our website for the full 100-city tour at democracynow.org. We have two job openings, hiring a broadcast engineer and director of finance and operations. Check democracynow.org. Happy birthday to Mike Burke and Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us.
A Washington Post investigation revealed that of all fatal shootings by police in 2015, almost one quarter involved a person who was mentally unstable. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on April 4th to hear St. Helens Police Chief Terry Moss discuss how crisis intervention training is changing how police interact with people with mental illness and how police are helping to divert them from incarceration. That's Prison Pipeline, April 4th at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th, starting at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. During this day-long workshop, Sewell Lecture Speaker Tim DeChristopher will share integrated and multi-faith strategies to prevent climate change and environmental injustice, combat poverty, and restore dignity to both people and the planet. Again, that's a Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting a forum for Portland Mayor on Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building, Boardroom, 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. This forum is in partnership with the Buckman Community Association. More voter information at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland air quality activists have begun protesting near the Southeast Portland Precision Cast Parts plant.
The Panama Papers, a massive trove of data revealing the details of secret offshore financial holdings of a dozen world leaders and other public officials, was leaked this week.
And the Obama administration is considering a plan that would greatly increase the number of U.S. soldiers on the ground in Syria.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 4th, 2016. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Portland air quality activists have begun protesting near the Southeast Portland Precision Cast Parts plant. The plant, located near Johnson Creek at Southeast 46th and Harney, opened in 1957 and makes titanium, nickel, cobalt, and steel alloys for jet engines and nuclear power plants. In December, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency released a report showing the area around the plant was a toxic hotspot, and residents in the area had a slightly increased cancer rate. In 2013, a University of Massachusetts research institute named the Precision Cast Parts Corporation as the number one toxic polluter in the entire nation. Recent water testing in Johnson Creek, near Precision Castparts, shows the water was contaminated with a toxic slew containing cobalt, hydrofluoric acid, sodium hydroxide, copper, lead, nickel, zinc, and arsenic. The factory is currently operating on an expired air pollution permit, and the Oregon DEQ has announced they plan on installing air monitors near the plant before renewing the permit. DEQ officials had asked Precision Castparts if the state agency could install air monitoring on site, but the company refused. The Oregon DEQ has stated they plan on making all testing results and information public.
A controversial private event was held last Friday at the Portland Police Training Facility near the airport. Members of the community protested the event, which was a private fundraiser hosted by the Portland Police Foundation and the Citizen Crime Commission. For more, here's KABU reporter Jenna Yokoyama with her coverage of the protest.
On a sunny Friday morning, a group of protesters stand along the sidewalk in front of the Portland Police Training Facility in Northeast Portland. At the center of their protest is a private fundraiser titled Meet the Heat that is being held inside. Hosted by the Portland Police Foundation and the Citizens Crime Commission, Meet the Heat has found criticism by many in the community. This invitation-only event advertises that people can meet members of the K-9 unit and Special Emergency Reaction Team, as well as learn about emergency vehicle maneuvers, firearms and tasers, realistic scenarios, and defense tactics. For the people protesting this event, the usage of a publicly owned building intended for use by the police for a private event is problematic, especially at a time when tensions between the police bureau and the community are in the limelight. The $1,000 ticket price to attend the fundraiser is also at the center of the controversy. Those protesting questioned the police bureau's decision to only allow those who can afford the high ticket price to view aspects of training when the bureau has denied the same access to the general public, citing safety concerns. I spoke with the protesters and asked them why it was important for them to be there.
So this activity is questionable whether they should even hold an event. This is the taxpayers' building. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. And they shouldn't be allowed to use the building, period, because it's a police bureau.
I'm troubled that people who have $1,000 can come play with violent toys as if it was a video game when real human lives are at stake.
I was revolted by the idea that people could get joy out of pretending to do violent things, learning to do violent things that police do.
The taxpayers of Portland paid for this building, this training facilities. I don't think that the intention was to have a private place for fundraising by the police foundation.
Just disrespects the role in the community that we're having enough trouble with our community relations with police as it is. This doesn't help.
All the injustice in that is revealed to us through the militarism of the police department, and it's going to be a problem. And as it turns out, what we need to do is we have to stop the violence before it happens, because if it happens, it's going to be ugly.
We need to take advantage of this moment when the Justice Department has come in and said, look, you need to change some things. And I feel like this event is moving in the wrong direction, where the police bureau and the city had agreed that they're going to try and improve tactics to move towards de-escalation. But in this event, we hear that what they're showing to the wealthy folks who are coming here is the old tactics, not de-escalation. So that in particular was one reason I came out today.
While ticket holders were inside, protesters rallied outside in front of the facility while Portland NAACP President Joanne Hardesty made a statement.
What I'm hopeful is because we stood up today that the media will know that the public's paying attention and that this is just not acceptable and this will never happen again. Let me tell you what leadership looks like. Leadership could have stopped this event. Right? If I was the mayor of the city of Portland and this came across my desk, there is no way in heck I would have approved this event from happening. That would have been leadership. Leadership would have said, this is not the right time for you to be creating an elite class of community members who have special access to the place. But our entire city council has been totally silent on this. That's the kind of political leadership we have today. I am hopeful we have better political leadership in the future, so that we don't have to come and protest a poor use of our tax dollars in a way that doesn't benefit our community.
Whether or not the Portland Police Bureau will continue to allow fundraising events to happen at the training facility is unknown. But one thing that is evident from this protest is that there are many in the community who are not afraid to express their dissatisfaction with the Bureau's decisions. For the KABU Evening News, I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And killed last week in Wallowa County near the town of Joseph in eastern Oregon. Oregon Fish and Wildlife officials determined that the wolves had killed four calves and a sheep in the area in March, leading to the decision to exterminate the wolves. The leader of the pack was 10-year-old Oregon Wolf 4, one of the first wolves to enter Oregon and who is believed to be the largest wolf in the state. In 2008, Wolf 4 swam the Snake River to enter Oregon. He fathered dozens of wolves over the next decade, including the wolves that migrated south to become California's first gray wolf pack in nearly 100 years. Last November, Oregon wolves were removed from the endangered species list, allowing for the extermination of the pack last week. Environmental activists are suing the state to have the wolves returned to the endangered species list. There are believed to be around 110 wolves currently roaming the state of Oregon.
GM has recalled more than 6,200 police cars due to a failure in power steering. The recall affects late-model Chevrolet Caprice police pursuit cars, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. No accidents or injuries have been reported as of yet. The recall was in response to a complaint from an Illinois police station after consistent failure in power steering. GM stated the issue arose because police cars are often driven for more than 20 hours a day and can overheat. This follows a recall of more than 500,000 trucks and SUVs with faulty brake pedals last month. The Multnomah County Sheriff's Office uses Caprices as their squad cars, though the Portland Police Bureau does not.
Each year, the Portland Blues community holds a special benefit concert supporting the campaign for single-payer health care in Oregon. This year, the event is Saturday, April 16th, starting at 6 p.m. at the Eagles North Portland Lodge. Here live in Studio 2 to talk about it is Norman Sylvester from Healthcare for All Oregon. Thank you for being here, Norman.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
First off, would you tell our listeners, what is single-payer healthcare?
Well, the key word there being single-payer is takes all that multi-insurance high money type out of the business, and it collects funds through a modest tax through the state, and it distributes that, and it pays for all the health care services. It's a universal health care process, and it's everybody in and nobody out. It's for everyone.
The interesting thing is, Norman, is this is not really a pie in the sky type of system. We have that in Scotland or the UK, Australia, France,
yes.
Germany,
mm-hmm.
the Scandinavian countries, but we don't have it in the U.S. What we do have is the Affordable Care Act. Do you know the difference between a single payer and what the Obama administration came up with for this bill?
The Affordable Care Act, I'm not privy on the difference. I know that I had to apply online for my wife and son, and it was a chaos for me to understand and implement through that website, but I finally was able to do it. So I know that in my heart that the universal single payer would be a much better process.
And simplifies things
yes,
quite a bit.
Yes, it does, for the average individual.
And we've all watched as President Obama's Affordable Care Act rolled out. How is it different from a single-payer system?
Well, you know, I think that what President Obama put out there, it was a step. It was what he was able to do, and I think that it was a positive thing, but it didn't roll out too well. We know that. So the dream and the process of campaigning for universal health care is what Healthcare for All Oregon is about.
And Healthcare for All Oregon, that's an organization that you founded or you belong
no,
to?
No. I have been part of the music festival for 5 years. This is the fifth annual. Healthcare for All Oregon has been around a little bit over that for sure. They received their nonprofit charter in 2012.
And Norman, what's your role then in organizing the Inner City Blues Festival along with Healthcare for All
I
Oregon?
I book all the music. the entertainment, the back line. And I do, what I'm doing here with you now, I go out and do interviews with different entities to help get the word out. I think it's about education. And the mission of Healthcare for All Oregon is to educate people about the healthcare. So if they need, people need to know more about that, just go to hcao.org and become a healthcare advocate, and they could get on board.
And is it difficult to get acts for the Inner City Blues Festival every year?
Or no.
Not among your musician friends? And
No. What's really wonderful about the music community in Portland is that they all come together as a family for musicians that need help. And we've had a lot of that here in recent years. And I've been a part of it. And a lot of the musicians, they are there on Sundays and, you know, just performing to make money and help families through crisis. And healthcare is one of the biggest crises. It comes out of nowhere.
And musicians, it's not really a job where healthcare is part of the plan, huh? It's something that's a little extra that you have to pay for. So it's not like you're working for a corporation or the government.
We're subcontractors.
Right.
You know, and it's just like small business. We're small businessmen. You know, we don't have that money in reserve for a catastrophic injury.
Now, we were talking before the interview about musicians who actually put on benefits for each other
yes.
when health issues arise. You were telling me, Norman, about a benefit that you recently put on in Salem?
No, I was a part of it. It was put on by a Salem-based musician, and we went up as a contingent from Portland, the Portland family. I went up with Sonny Hess and Lisa Mann, and LaRon Steele was there, you know, so we just went to contribute from Portland for John Pounds, who is recovering from a stroke at the present time. He's down, you know, it's just, we just have to, we never know what bridge we're going to cross. So it's really nice to be there for our community friends.
So if we had a single payer system rather than the Affordable Care Act, what would be the long-term impact for society in general?
If we had single payer?
Yeah.
Less stress, less catastrophic stress, less property loss, less bankruptcies. We'll have a happier future, a brighter future for our children and grandchildren. You know, I'm 70 years old, so before I got Medicare, I was paying $630 a month for insurance myself. You know, so, you know, I just want to see something change. You know, I have kids, grandkids, and I would like to see a brighter future for them as far as healthcare goes.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the acts we'll be seeing at the Inner City Blues Festival?
Yeah, it's a wonderful night of entertainment. We have Marilyn Keller and the Augustana Jazz Quartet. We have Terry Robb on acoustic guitar. Norman Sylvester, you might know who that guy is.
Yes.
He'll be there.
Familiar.
My daughter, Lynn-Ann, will be with me, and Sarah Billings. We'll have Shoehorn, the tap dance and saxophonist. And we have Blanco Oliveira, which is a Rio-style samba dance group. Beautiful procession dance. And the Northwest Women in Blues with Sonny Hess, Ray Gordon, Lady Cat, Blue Cat, and Vicki Stevens. And we'll close out with the Roseland Hunters, which is Michael Quimby. He plays that New Orleans dumpster funk, kind of a New Orleans groove. So it's a full night of, we have a silent auction, community village for informational tables. I think KBOO was on the community village. I had a table there for a while. And
oh, yes.
And you guys are co-sponsoring us, and thank you for that as well.
And simulcasting.
Simulcasting, too.
Yes, indeed. So if you can't make it, tune in on KBOO. But there's one musician I think you left out who I was telling you was one of my favorites.
Oh, yes.
Who I discovered, you know, the first I had heard him was at the festival, I think, 2 years ago. Tevis Hodge Jr.
Yes.
Plays an acoustic blues, kind of almost like a Delta blues,
well,
like a Robert Johnson style.
Deeper than that, Tevis is a young man that collects 78 records.
Ah.
You see what I'm saying? By edition number when it came out. So he's really done his homework.
And how many years have y'all done this benefit?
This is the fifth annual.
Fifth annual, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So for the people who can't show up, Norman, and have to resort to KBOO to get their share of this great music, how can they support your work on single payer? besides attending the benefit, or if they weren't able to attend the benefit?
Well, of course, on the hcao.org, there is a donation page if they want to support the organization and volunteer for, you know, street team type stuff, getting the word out.
Yep. Well, thank you, Norman. This was Norman Sylvester from Healthcare for All Oregon. And the Inner City Blues Festival, Healing the Healthcare Blues, is this coming Saturday, April 16th, not this coming Saturday, it's Saturday, April the 16th, from 6 p.m. to midnight at the Eagles North Portland Lodge, 7611 North Exeter Avenue in Portland. And so if you'd like more information, please go to www.hcao.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with authors Ken and Chris Bilderback about the history of the death penalty in Oregon and their book, Law and Order at the End of the Oregon Trail, conducted by KBOO's Natasha Delapine. This is followed by Labor Radio at 6, and this week the hosts are joined by Olivia Pace, a student and activist at Portland State University and a founding member of the Portland State University Student Labor Action Project. They'll be talking about the campaign to raise the minimum wage for all campus workers to $15 an hour. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Host Karen James interviews Terry Moss, police chief of St. Helens, Oregon, who promotes Crisis Intervention Training, or CIT. Moss explains how CIT is changing how police interact with people with mental illness. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather: a 40% chance of showers, mainly before 8 p.m., mostly cloudy, with a low around 44. Tomorrow, partly sunny, with a high near 62. Today in history, in 1968, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. And in 1988, the Arizona State Senate convicted Governor Evan Minkum of two charges of official misconduct and removed him from office. The quote of the day is from Dr. King, who said, "The curse of poverty has no justification in our age. It's socially as cruel and blind as the practice of cannibalism at the dawn of civilization, when men ate each other because they had not yet learned to take food from the soil or to consume the abundant animal life around them. The time has come for us to civilize ourselves by the total, direct, and immediate abolition of poverty."
It's 5:22. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Today, please allow me to have a personal moment with you regular listeners to my Hightower radio commentaries. For nearly 25 years now, I've proudly been radioactive. I don't mean contaminated with radiation, but joyfully using this wonderful megaphone called radio to spread an undiluted populist message all across the country and beyond. Since 1993, I've been airing my 2-minute Little Pops of Populism 5 times a week on about 200 terrific stations like this one. In the past couple of years, however, I've taken on several extra loads of work, including the development of other progressive media resources, trying to connect various populist groups into a nationwide grassroots network, traveling all over to support the growing number of populist issue campaigns and candidates, and expanding the internet outreach of my Hightower Lowdown newsletter and podcasts. Find them at hightowerlowdown.org. To keep all of this flowing and to keep me on the top side of the grass, I need to rebalance my workload. That doesn't mean I would give up my Pops of Populism broadcasts. After all, staying radioactive is what lets me connect directly to you, generating irreplaceable feedback and ideas from the local community. Rather, I'm simply reducing the frequency of the commentaries to 2 new commentaries each week, combined with 3 of my classic commentaries. This will keep them and me fresh. Each one will remain 100% pure populist and will be delivered, as we say in Texas, with a passion hotter than high school love. This is Jim Hightower saying thank you. Thanks to you who keep tuning in for my populist take and to all of you activists who respond to my frequent calls for grassroots action. And thanks especially to the radio stations that are keeping my populist voice and viewpoint on the public airwaves. Please stay tuned and let's keep being radioactive together. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists this weekend revealed the existence of a massive amount of data revealing secret offshore financial holdings of a dozen world leaders. The leaked documents also reveal the financial holdings of more than 30 people and companies sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control. Among its findings, the ICIJ uncovered that a secret network with ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin has moved at least $2 billion through banks and shell companies linked to Putin's inner circle. The papers identify about 140 offshore companies linked to public officials, other politicians, and their families. The so-called Panama Papers were leaked from the law firm Mossack Fonseca, which is based in Panama, but has offices in more than 35 cities around the world, including Zurich, Hong Kong, and Miami. The Panama Papers represent the largest leak in digital history, with 2.6 terabytes of data, compromising more than 11 million documents.
The U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling today that civil and human rights experts say affirms the principle of one person, one vote. The Supremes ruled unanimously in the case of Evanwell versus Abbott, upholding a lower court decision. The case arose because Texas drew up its legislative districts using population counts only of people who were eligible to vote, which excluded children and other non-voters in the district. In a unanimous decision written by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the court found, quote, as the framers of the Constitution and the 14th Amendment comprehended, representatives serve all residents, not just those eligible to vote. Non-voters have an important stake in many policy debates and in receiving constituent services. By ensuring that each representative is subject to requests and suggestions from the same number of constituents, total population apportionment promotes equitable and effective representation.
The Utah bill requiring anesthesia for patients receiving an abortion after 20 weeks or more was signed into law last week. The new law would require many clinics to employ specialty staff and could possibly delay the procedure, making it more dangerous for women to undergo. The new law comes amid the argument of when a fetus can feel pain. Many doctors would find the unnecessary use of anesthesia unethical and would be resistant to performing an abortion with unneeded medication. There's no fiscal attachment to the bill that would cover the extra cost of using anesthesia and would also increase the price of obtaining a legal abortion in the state of Utah.
The childhood home of Malcolm X is undergoing an archaeological dig after Malcolm's nephew, Rodnell Collins, decided to open it up to public tours. The home, located in the traditionally African-American neighborhood of Roxbury in Boston, is where Malcolm X moved during his teen years and where he first began his transition from Malcolm Little to Malcolm X. The home, which had been designated a historical site since the 90s, has fallen into disrepair. Collins hopes to raise money so the house can continue to serve as an historical landmark.
The TransCanada Corporation announced this weekend that it's closing its Keystone Oil Pipeline until at least this Friday in order to repair a leak. The company on Saturday reported that a leak had been discovered in a rural portion of South Dakota. The company's in the process of removing the oil and attempting to repair the leak and have issued no estimate of how many gallons may have been spilled. The portions of the pipeline that have been shut down run from Hardisty, Alberta to Wood River, Illinois, and from Steel City, Nebraska to Cushing, Oklahoma. TransCanada's Gulf Coast line from Cushing, Oklahoma to Nederland, Texas remains operational.
Two Libyans held at the U.S. base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba have been released to Senegal from the military prison. Salim Abu Salam Garibi and Omar Khalif Mohammed Abu Bakr are the first of 36 prisoners who've been cleared to be sent back to their homes or other countries. Among those to be resettled is Tariq Ba Oba, a citizen of Yemen who is on a long-term hunger strike. He has been force-fed by nasal tubes since 2007, and his weight has dropped to 74 pounds. Previous transfers have sent prisoners to Ghana, Oman, Bosnia, and Montenegro.
The Obama administration is considering a plan that would greatly increase the number of U.S. soldiers on the ground in Syria. Currently, there are believed to be around 50 U.S. Special Operations troops in Syria. The new U.S. forces would work closely with the Kurdish military and other moderate rebel groups, providing training, logistical support, and weaponry. An earlier attempt at training moderate rebels in Syria collapsed after it was revealed that the $500 million the U.S. military spent produced fewer than 10 trained rebels. The vast majority of trainees defected with their weapons. Now that the Islamic State is in retreat, U.S. officials are claiming that numerous rebel groups are ready and willing to take on IS.
India's capital, New Delhi, is getting a makeover with dozens of local and international street artists setting out on a mission to transform the city's landscape. With a view to making art accessible to everyone, the artists are using Delhi's footpaths and walls, along with transportation containers, as a platform for the expression of their imagination. Bismil Agalani from Free Speech Radio News spent some time with the artist at work and reports how artworks are being used to impart social and political messages besides enhancing public spaces.
The inland container depot on the outskirts of Delhi is Asia's largest dry port. Usually buzzing with the honks and squeals of moving vehicles, the surroundings these days are much calmer. Since early February, the port has been turned into a venue for the Delhi Street Art Festival, and dozens of artists are at work amid a backdrop of live music and dance performances. Akshat Norial is co-founder of the Start India Foundation, the group organizing the festival.
Ours is a not-for-profit group, and through these festivals, we are trying to take artworks out of the conventional galleries and enclosed spaces to make it available to a wider audience. In India, enjoying artworks is thought to be an activity for the elite or people from the upper middle class. What we are trying to do is democratize art and make it accessible to everyone.
This year's Delhi Street Art Festival is the fourth of its kind. This time, organizers made shipping containers the primary canvas. French artist Sowat sees it as a homecoming for street art.
Graffiti was born on trains. Yeah. It was always the idea of having rolling museums, you know, and painting your work somewhere and having it travel throughout the city or throughout the country. So that's what I think is the most exciting. Who knows where the hell this container is going to end up? You know, who knows who is going to see it? That's why I think it's even bigger than street art, because those containers are going to travel through the country and they're not even going to be seen by people from the urban spaces. They're going to be, I hope, they're going to see being seen by people that live in the countryside.
Street art has had to fight a certain stigma in many countries, with aerosol paintings in public spaces not receiving the same level of respect as visual art in other mediums, like oil paintings on canvas. Street artists in many countries face fines or criminal penalties. But events like the Delhi Street Art Festival are helping to shift perspectives of the public and even of the art establishment. Abhilash Khandekar is a veteran art critic for one of India's leading newspapers.
Delhi being what it is, Delhi has been a center of international art. There have been a lot of museums, art galleries, but this something is really, really very good. Containers being used for as art walls is something really new and different. This is a wonderful exposure for me, and I'm amazed and I'm really, very happy to be here.
Some of the artworks that stand out include a massive mural of an astronaut staring into space, an Indian goddess riding a dragon, and a wall painted with the word "breed" using a special black ink made from particular matter and carbon, emphasizing the urgent need for clean air in the world's most polluted city. Local artist Harsh Raman has used a vibrant palette of colors to create a mural of what he describes as the god of street art.
In India, there's a god for everything, yeah? But there's no god for street art. So I thought that it would be interesting to explore that idea of kind of creating some kind of a deity for street art and creating some kind of a movable shrine.
But Gaya, a street artist and muralist from the United States, is more concerned with global warming.
So what you have here is the Alto Matsuri Suzuki car in repeat, and they're superimposed over half of a gigantic globe. And then you have eventually, it has not yet been completed, but a portrait of a man named Malcolm McLean. And he is credited with really innovating the container and bringing it to a level where it could in fact be standardized and utilized by all sorts of shipping companies beyond Sealand.
With his painting of one of India's top selling cars, Gaya tries to bring attention to the role of urban living in exacerbating the problem of global warming.
We're seeing the advent of the megacity, and so as you have the sort of the pooling of labor from the countryside into the city and the exploitation of the traditional lifestyle, and that of course creates a tendency or a need or a want or a desire to also be able to have the comforts and the conveniences of access to medication, access to clean water, but of course also access to cars and your own vehicle and your own spatial autonomy.
Among other works, a portrait of the late Iranian poet and activist Farooq Farrokhzad by Iranian artist Nafir signifies the importance of the struggle for women's rights in conservative societies. Within the context of the festival, the organizers have joined hands with the local government to convert a residential area in Delhi into what is being called the country's first art district. Magnificent wall murals with local and international artists exploring a wide range of styles and themes are transforming the capital's historically and architecturally significant Lodhi colony into an open-air art gallery. The organizers hope the initiative will create a greater demand for street art in the country and broaden career options for budding young artists. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
The FCC took steps to narrow the digital divide in the U.S. this week. The vote proved contentious, but in the end, the commission approved a subsidy to help low-income consumers afford broadband internet access. Nell Abram from Free Speech Radio News has more.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it.
FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler called the vote Thursday, expanding the more than 30-year-old Lifeline program to include high-quality internet service. Lifeline began in 1985, designed to help low-income households afford landline telephones. It was later expanded to include cell service. The new rules allow Lifeline recipients to apply the program's $9.25 monthly subsidy toward broadband internet bills. Commissioner Mignon Clyburn spearheaded the move.
My vision was well-intentioned and simple: to reform a program for the past 30 years has been stuck in an analog time warp, and beam that program into the 21st century, making it future-proof, competitive, and loaded with choice for deserving consumers.
Media justice advocates are hailing the Lifeline reform, saying it will allow as many as 40 million low-income individuals to more easily apply for jobs, do homework, and stay in touch with friends and family. Recipients will be able to use the price offset for either standalone residential access or bundled cell service. Participating telecom providers must offer Lifeline plans that include at least 500 minutes of voice service or 500 megabytes of data. According to the FCC, nearly half of the poorest households in the U.S. can't afford internet access. To qualify, recipients must earn no more than 135% of the federal poverty level or receive food stamps or Medicaid. But critics on the commission cried foul at the hearing, saying Democrats welched at the last minute on a bipartisan compromise on capping the program. Last-minute negotiations delayed the Thursday vote by several hours. Republican Commissioner Ajit Pai voted against the reform.
It turns out that since early this morning, perhaps even late last night, the chairman and his staff have been actively working to undermine and unwind that bipartisan compromise. Those efforts started with leaking non-public information to the press. The chairman's office then encouraged lawmakers and stakeholders from the usual gaggle of left-wing special interests in Washington to even former FCC commissioners to blast the deal before the votes could be cast, indeed before they even knew what the deal was.
The measure passed nonetheless, but the partisan rancor was evident in the final 3-2 vote that fell along party lines. Lifeline subsidies come from an FCC fund to which all telecom companies are required to contribute. Many pass on that fee to consumers as a phone bill charge labeled Universal Services. The new rules for the program take effect in December. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenna Yokoyama, Robin Ryan, Don Zur, Grace Ann Smith, Ken Jones, Rosalind Scott, and Jeff Henderson. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Natasha Delapine. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Representative Greg Walden is 541-389-4408. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number, 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9 on Alternative Radio, Richard Falk speaks on U.S. special relationships in the Middle East. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host D. May Roberts features the Amish Project at Portland Actors Conservatory, which revolves around the 2006 killing of 5 Amish girls in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Andre Middleton interviews comic artist Stephen Christian about his work, The Island of Illtopia, a visual art series that follows the lives of 3 characters. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now, stay tuned for an interview by KBOO's Natalie Delapine with authors Ken and Chris Bilderback about their book, Law and Order at the End of the Oregon Trail and the History of the Death Penalty in Oregon. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Rosalind. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Retired journalist and author Ken Bilderback is lecturing about the history of capital punishment in Oregon tomorrow, Tuesday at noon, at the United Church of Christ in Forest Grove. KBOO's Natasha Delapine caught up with Ken last week to find out more about his upcoming talk.
Not only is it nonfiction, but it's about Oregon itself. And you've been a journalist in Oregon for how long now?
Well, actually, none of my journalism experience, really, other than some part-time stuff now, is in Oregon. But for about 30 years, I was a newspaper reporter and editor everywhere, starting in high school back in Detroit, Michigan, and then moving on as a career. But for the past 12 years, we've been living in rural Washington County, writing history books, mostly about Washington County, but this is our fourth history book. This one really expands well beyond Washington County. It covers the entire Oregon Territory and the state of Oregon. But really the incident we're going to focus on today just happens to have been a murder trial in Washington County that kind of illustrates many of the most significant points of the death penalty.
How did you find out about this murder trial?
Well, as I mentioned, this is our fourth history book. And my wife, Chris, spends hundreds of hours research. We both do, but Chris spends the bulk of it. Hundreds of hours of research, largely of newspaper archives, not surprisingly, since that's my background. And so we started by searching for stories specific to Gaston, which is the small town we live nearby. But since then, it's just grown and expanded. And you never know what you're going to find when you're going through all the old historical newspapers. And we stumbled upon this case.
What about this case that brought you to write this section of the book specifically about this murder trial, this hanging?
Well, because the murder itself took place in 1895. And as you probably know, the state of Oregon became a state in 1859. And so we started tracing all the executions, the legal executions in the state of Oregon. And there were a lot of issues with